Good evening and welcome to the July 2025 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Morelia. Tonight I'm excited to welcome another regular new voice to our show. Raif Darazi returns and is going to be our new HIV and AIDS correspondent, providing monthly updates on the latest information you need to know about the pandemic. And of course, Finn Dearheart will join me to discuss some of this month's important news. But first, we'll meet Bill Hulsman, who's here to talk about his new memoir titled Six to Carry the Casket and One to Say the Mass. So stay with us. It's coming up next right after your Outbeat Radio news for this Sunday, July 27th, 2025. This is Greg Morelia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of July 27th, 2025. A church leader in Indianapolis is doubling down on a sermon delivered at the Sure Foundation Baptist Church in the state's capital earlier this month that called on gay people to, quote, blow yourself in the back of the head, among other very incendiary statements. Church leader Justin Zhang endorsed the remarks delivered by Pastor Stephen Falco during a men's preaching night service at the end of June. He said, quote, there's nothing good to be proud of in being an expletive, meaning gay. You ought to blow yourself in the back of the head. You're so disgusting, end quote. The sermon was posted on YouTube, and it was widely denounced by members of the LGBTQ plus community and allies who called the hate-filled rant theologically irresponsible and pastorally dangerous, end quote. YouTube since removed the video for violating its terms of service, but a portion of the sermon was reposted by radio station 93 WIBC in Indianapolis. Another man identified in the same video as Brother Wayne followed Falco at the pulpit with a sermon he called, quote, worthy of being beaten. According to the Indianapolis Star, he blamed society's moral decline on the lack of discipline and physical punishment, calling beatings a deterrent that have been lost in American culture, while aiming his harshest rhetoric at immigrants and the LGBTQ plus community. Equality Indiana called Falco's sermon inflammatory and extremist, saying it could inspire violence against the LGBTQ plus community. And as President Trump's administration ends the National Suicide Prevention Hotline support options for LGBTQ plus youth, California is looking to fill the void by partnering with the Trevor Project. Earlier this month, Governor Gavin Newsom announced a partnership between the nonprofit and the state's Health and Human Service Agency to provide counselors at the 12988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline call centers in California with enhanced training to respond to the needs of LGBTQ plus youth. Newsom said, quote, while the Trump administration continues its attack on LGBTQ kids, California has a message to the gay community. We see you and we're here for you. We're going to be proud to work with the Trevor Project to ensure that every person in our state gets the support they need to live a happy and healthy life, end quote. During his first term in office, Trump signed legislation designating 988 as the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, similar to the 911 emergency services. But as the Mercury News reported, under former President Joe Biden, the Trevor Project began providing specialized support for LGBTQ plus youth through the 988 hotline, starting back in September of 2022. And since then, the service has connected an estimated 1.5 million LGBTQ plus young people with support, and the Trevor Project has handled roughly half of the hotline's overall call. And Lambda Legal reports that over $6 million in grant funding to nine different organizations was restored after a judge's decision last month against the Trump administration. Jose Abrigo, Lambda Legal's senior attorney and HIV project director, said, quote, we've confirmed that our plaintiffs, LGBTQ plus organizations providing critical services to their communities, have seen their threatened funding restored. When we fight, we win. We know the battle is far from over and there will be setbacks along the way, but the cause is too important and the need too great for us to lose heart. Lambda Legal represented plaintiffs in the San Francisco AIDS Foundation versus Trump case. According to the Bay Area Reporter, U.S. District Judge John Tegar granted a preliminary injunction temporarily blocking the Trump administration from defunding nine different LGBTQ plus and HIV organizations. And here in the North Bay, beginning next school year, parents at the Howell Mountain Elementary School in Angwin, that's in Napa County, will be able to pull their children from classes that include LGBTQ plus inclusive storybooks. The 85-student K-8 district is among the first in California to move swiftly in response to a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision that sided with Maryland parents who argued their religious freedoms were being violated when their children were required to read LGBT-themed storybooks. But the Howell Mountain District may go even further. At its scheduled August 19th meeting, the board is set to consider whether to adopt an opt-in policy, meaning students would be exposed to LGBTQ+ content only if their parents explicitly approve it ahead of time. This would mark a more restrictive approach than the one suggested by the Supreme Court and would violate California's Fair and Inclusive Education Act. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moraglia. My first guest tonight is Bill Holzman, whose new autobiography, Six to Carry the Casket and One to Say the Mass, immediately caught my attention, both by the title and from his experience growing up in the Catholic Church and discovering he's gay. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here to talk about your new book. I'm excited to share this with our listeners. But before we get to that, this is a book about you and your life. It's a series of essays and stories about your life. So give us some context. Set us in the time that you grew up and what it was like discovering you were gay at that time.
Yeah. Well, I am a bicentennial baby. So 1976, I was born, and even in my, to give you a little glimpse of the culture of the moment, in my baby book, my mom identified Liza Minnelli and Harry Chapin as the biggest celebrities of the day, which I don't know if that was true, but it felt like foreshadowing for me.
Yeah.
So I grew up with Cheers and the Golden Girls. You know, they were the dominant kind of cultural influences in my home. And I was in high school in the 90s, you know, when angst was king. But I was really lucky to be in high school in the 90s in terms of the music. The music, you know, in the 90s was, I think 92 is or 93 is talked about as a pivotal year for the music industry. And so it was a great soundtrack to life in those days. I grew up in the suburbs outside of Chicago. If you've ever seen a film by John Hughes, like 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club, Home Alone, these were all filmed in my hometown.
Nice.
And he grew up not too far away, and he used his films to portray that little part of the world and also to skewer it in a lot of ways. And I think both the portrait and the skewering have always been pretty spot on. Very white, very affluent, very heteronormative. But my mom grew up in the city. She grew up in Edison Park and Lincoln Park.
Okay.
And so we always felt really connected to the city. And I think that was a bit of an antidote for me of not getting too sucked in or too dazzled by suburban life. I'm not sure I discovered I was gay, you know, as a little kid. I think I always knew I was different and I didn't have language for it.
Right.
I didn't have a vocabulary. I didn't know anybody. There was nobody in my family at the time who was out, who was visible to me in pop culture. We didn't see ourselves reflected unless it was terribly tragic, you know? So I didn't have language for it. And yet I was drawn to a lot of things that are, you know, my OGTs, my original gay traits. You know, I was enamored of Angela Lansbury and Bernadette Peters because I was obsessed with musical theater, and I had no idea why I was obsessed with musical theater. But it was just one of those things. I was drawn to hanging out with girls and playing with dolls instead of playing sports and video games with boys. So, you know, that whole thing, it just made me feel displaced, and I didn't understand why I didn't fit in. Seventh and eighth grade, I started to understand more. And actually in eighth grade, I did my science fair project on HIV and AIDS, which I think back to it. And I was in a little Catholic parish school and the science teacher let me run with it and was very supportive. And I think back to that, like, she could have shut it down because it was uncomfortable territory.
Sure.
Or I was going to be exposed to things that they didn't want me exposed to, but she let me run with it. And doing research on HIV and AIDS was like my introduction to sex ed. It was particularly gay sex. Those were the early kind of points where I started to piece things together. Mm-hmm. by the time I was starting high school, I was like, okay, I'm gay. I'm going to be gay. It's going to be great. Started high school, first day of high school, classmate threw me up against the wall and spit the word faggot in my face, and I filed it away, and I said, well,
so much for that.
So there was a bit of a pause in terms of really owning and claiming my sexual identity. And it was more because I was in an all-boys Catholic high school. It was a huge school. It was very intimidating for queer kids, for queer students.
Sure.
So by the time I got to college, I had intellectually resolved it. You know, I understood it, and I was ready to name myself, and I was ready to step into, you know, being my full self. And I had all the conflicts resolved intellectually, you know, but practically not so much. So that's when college, I started gaying it up. And I, you know, so in the late 90s, that's when I was sort of coming out. And I went to a small Jesuit liberal arts college. And I was one, I could count on my hands how many people were out on campus the first few years. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting time. It was an interesting time to grow up. I was like right on the cusp of, you know, I was in the last generation before cell phones and the last generation before we had vocabulary, you know, teenagers and, you know, younger kids actually had vocabulary to talk about sexual identity. So that's the world I grew up in.
Yeah. And, you know, you talk in the book a lot about the role that religion played in your life. It was yeah. obviously a significant part. And you asked the question a lot about what got you interested in religion. And I would imagine going through a Catholic school was a good part of it, but where else did that come from?
Yeah, thank you. I had a really positive experience of religion as a kid, and I know that's not something that a lot of people say, particularly a lot of queer people. Mm-hmm. And I'm not out to negate anybody else's experience. I'm not out to convert anybody, but I had a really positive experience. My parents were very Catholic. I'm the youngest of 10, if that tells you anything. But they were not, you know, they didn't fit the stereotype of the conservative Catholics. You know, we were not in that camp in the church. My parents were pretty progressive. They were more interested in social justice and ethics and thinking things through. And my mom gave me the language of the primacy of conscience. So, you know, in Catholic theology, there's this idea that your conscience is the thing in you that is closest to God. And when your conscience tells you yes or no, or right or wrong, that trumps laws, the church, even whatever the Pope says. You know, if your conscience tells you this is right, then that's what mm-hmm. was right. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a little Catholic civil disobedience, I like to think of it as. And so my mom cited that a lot. You know, she would, if she disagreed with something that the Pope said, she would say, "Oh well, he's just another priest." You know, so she didn't buy into the power structure of the church. She really saw church as what we did and what we experienced, and we built up from there. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a disposition that I inherited from my family, kind of an openness to it because it was a positive thing. But as a kid, I remember being in church and fascinated with, you know, at 5 or 6 years old, you're not totally engaged in the liturgy, but I was engaged with the statuary and the paintings and the colors and the letter, you know, foreign words and foreign letters were all over the place. And it was all stories that I didn't know or I didn't know yet. And so it piqued my interest as a little kid. And then I started paying attention to the choreography of the Mass, of Catholic liturgy. I thought it was fascinating. You know, everybody knew when to stand up and sit down, and everybody knew when to move forward and when to respond and the common responses. And so I thought that was interesting. It piqued my interest. And when I was an altar server, you know, I think a lot of people think, you get to peek behind the curtain and that'll ruin the magic. That'll like, oh, this is how the sausage gets made. That didn't ruin the magic for me. That actually only enhanced it because it gave me this sense that here we're all doing this together because we all want to experience something. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing to think about, like, all the pieces, the environment, the actions, the mental disposition. I was interested in how that all swirled together and created this community that was seeking some sort of a connection or some sort of experience. So I took that with me when, you know, going into high school religion classes and college, you know, I declared a religious studies major pretty quickly because it was interdisciplinary and because it let me explore things not just from a single point of view, but, you know, a little bit historical, a little bit theological, a little bit philosophical, a little bit aesthetic, even integrating insights from the sciences. You know, it. So the coursework was also more interesting to me because of the diversity of perspectives that you could play with in studying religion. But my experience of religion wasn't all cerebral. It wasn't all academic. It was very personal. It was very powerful. I had very profound religious experiences. You know, sometimes it was in a liturgical context or like in retreats in high school. I had very profound experiences of community that in which I felt connected to God in a different way than I had before. It gave me a taste of there's something out there that I want to keep accessing, that I want to keep returning to. You know, but it hasn't all been in liturgy. Sometimes I'm sitting, you know, in a park and I find myself just at peace and contemplating whatever is in front of me, and I feel connected to something. You know, so it, so from having a really positive experience growing up and having vocabulary to talk about it in a meaningful way, it was always a very positive experience for me.
Talk about your passion for lists. I thought that was one of the things that was really interesting in your book. And talk about that passion and then how you use those lists in the book.
Yeah, I'm a Virgo. it's a characteristic common to a lot of Virgos is we like things organized. List making is a tool that apparently a lot of Virgos use. I also live with OCD, and list making is one of those things that I can obsess over, but it also helps me kind of impose order over chaos, you know, or what I perceive as chaos. It helps me kind of calm things down, slow it down, and see what I need to see or understand what I need to understand. At the beginning of the book, I use an essay that's just a bunch of lists, and I use that as a way to introduce myself. You know, so much of the book tells you the stories about my experiences growing up and in adulthood and career and everything, but I wanted a different way to kind of introduce myself. And so it was my way of welcoming readers into my head. Like, these are really the things that I think about, and this is really the system that I use to try to make order of it so that I don't feel overwhelmed by whatever information is coming at me or whatever feelings are swirling, you know, for me. So there's a kind of a practical, kind of emotional use for lists. But then I also just enjoy the aesthetic of a list. You know, it's a nice, clean way to keep things going. Well, but it really was intentional about a way of introducing people, welcoming people into my head.
Well, and one of the examples of a list that you use is one that I can relate to, and that is putting up a Christmas tree. And in my family, there was a very distinct order to all of that. Yeah. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I loved writing that piece. It started, it emerged from the experience of putting up a tree with my husband. The second Christmas that we were married was 2020, and we had spent, you know, the majority of that year in quarantine. So we had a lot of time to think about how are we going to decorate for the holidays. And we got a new tree. And in the process of the new tree and sort of recognizing and relishing this new life that we were creating together, I was paying attention to what was coming up for me. And what was coming up for me were small memories, you know, little things. Not huge events, not huge traumas or joys in the past, but, you know, little things that were attached to the holidays. And the process of putting up a tree and unpacking ornaments, and that triggered all these memories to come up. It made me think a lot about my mom's process, and I've really adopted my mom's process. You know, we were a big family, there were a lot of ornaments, it was a huge tree. And so there was this beautiful routine every year where we would go up to the attic and bring down all the boxes, and then one box at a time we'd unpack things, and every ornament was wrapped in a piece of newspaper or a piece of paper towel. And, you know, the newspapers were interesting because you could see what was happening the day that this ornament was wrapped up, you know, 40 years ago or whatever. And then there were, you know, moments where my mom would tell stories about, oh, that ornament came from so-and-so or da-da-da-da. Or, you know, there were ornaments that each of us were designated for, you know, that were gifts to us. And so it was like, oh, that's Peggy's ornament. You know, bring that over to Peggy. And then it was Peggy's job to put it on the tree. So I loved that process because it was an easy way to sit, do something with our hands and sit as a family and tell stories, you know, things that came up organically, not just, you know, things that pushed. That we were pushing forward into the conversation. So it was, and for me, it was kind of this stream of consciousness experience of all the things that were coming up, the memories that were coming up from family, but also recognition of this life with John and our dog Stella, who died a couple of years ago, but was central to that, to those moments. It was overwhelming to me, and it was, in a beautiful way, and especially after an incredibly different year and difficult year in 2020. Why did I do it in a list? Because I didn't want to try to streamline all those memories. I wanted to keep it stream of consciousness, but I still needed to impose some order over the chaos.
Sure.
So I resulted to my method to be able to do that.
It's just a really interesting way to read a story. Well, I'm going to ask you about the title of the book, because that's one of the things that originally caught my eye. One of the essays includes some details about where six to carry the casket and one to say the mass came from.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, the title is taken from an essay about my mom. When my mom turned 80 years old, we threw a party for her. And this was about 3 months before she died. And she had been declining. She had been experiencing chemo, you know, as part of a treatment for a cancer that was recurring. And but we had this party, and it was a beautiful celebration. And my sisters, who organized it, went down the list of the siblings, like, okay, somebody's got to give a toast. Somebody's got to stand up and do this. And they went down the list. No, he didn't do it. He shouldn't do it. Nope, we don't want him to talk. Nope, he shouldn't do it. They got to the bottom of the list, and that was me. And they said, oh, Bill will do it. Well, instead of doing a kind of a traditional toast, I didn't feel like that fit my mom. So I wanted to share her greatest hits. So the phrases that lived in our memory that she would use a lot, the quips, the little kind of Sheila proverbs that I think of them as. So I shared her, what I thought were her top 10 greatest hits, the things that she would say. After she died and after some time, I went back to that speech and expanded it and developed more about her and about our relationship together and her impact on me, both the really beautiful stuff and the really tough stuff. But the title goes back to something that she would say when people balked at how many children she had. Mm-hmm. So if you know, someone would say, you have 10 children? And she'd say, they're from my husband's first marriage. Which technically she was her husband's first marriage, but it was enough to deflect and kind of throw people off track. But if they found out that she had 7 sons and they said, 7 boys, why do you have 7 sons? And her response was always, well, God gave me 7 sons for a reason, 6 to carry the casket and 1 to say the mass.
Mm.
So as my brothers were growing up, it was clear that they were not headed to seminary. So I think when I declared a religious studies major and went to divinity school, I think my mom saw a prophecy coming to fruition. Finally, I'm going to get a priest in the family. One to say the funeral. But it was also a kind of a running joke in our family about my mom prepared us for her death from the moment we were born. You know, so I spent 40 years getting ready for her to die. She would do things like, you know, say things like that, you know, just drop a little, or she would hear a song and say, oh, I want that at my funeral. And we all thought that was, you know, that was her way of being funny. She would also, if you ever gave her a gift, she would say, before she said thank you, a permanent marker would appear out of nowhere and she'd write your name on the bottom or your initials. And so you go around the house and you pick up things and there are names all over the place. And she'd say, well, I don't want kids fighting over stuff when I'm gone. You know, so for me as an 8-year-old to hear that, like, well, got to start getting ready for mom to die. Cool.
So interesting. So interesting.
So it's a little cut, a deep cut into her very, very Irish Catholic wit.
Yeah. Well, the book is called Six to Carry the Casket and One to Say the Mass by Bill Holzman. Bill, where can people go to follow you, and where can they go to get a copy of the book?
BillHolzman.com is my primary website, both for my ritual design business and for the book. So BillHolzman.com. And I'm also Bill Holzman Rituals on Instagram and Facebook. And I've been keeping those up to date as much as possible with updates about the book, and there are links to order through a variety of channels. And I encourage people to go to their local independent bookstore, if they've got a local independent bookstore. What a great opportunity to go in and ask for a new book.
Agreed. And if you missed that website, we will have it on our own website at outbeatnews.com. Just go to the top of the page, click on show notes, and there will be a link to Bill's website. Bill, congratulations. These are wonderful essays. I think nice reflections, especially for folks that grew up in the general decades that you and I did. I think we'll see a lot of ourselves in those stories.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the time.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Outbeat News in Depth here on KRCB Radio. I'm Greg Moralia. Well, last month we announced that we're updating the format of the show to bring you more regular voices. And this month I want to reintroduce you to Raif Darazi, who will be providing us with monthly updates on HIV and AIDS. Raif was on our show some months ago and has been producing regular reports on his own YouTube channel. And this is particularly important now, especially as the federal administration is removing content from websites about HIV and AIDS. Raif, welcome to the team.
Hey, thank you so much.
Well, I'm super excited about having you join our team as a regular contributor. I mean, you've become such a subject matter expert in the entire area of HIV and AIDS. But for our listeners who may not have heard your initial interview with us, tell us a little bit about your story and how this became such an important topic for you.
Yeah, it was really such an organic journey for me. I certainly didn't have any of it planned out. In 2012, I was diagnosed with AIDS. It was a complete shock to me. I had no idea that, you know, that anything like that could have an impact on my life. And shortly after, I was looking for visibility, representation, people that look like me on social media. And I really wasn't seeing a whole lot. And over the course of time, as I was healing myself and doing a lot of inner work, I began to ask myself the question if that was something that I would be willing to do. Because if I was looking for that, guaranteed, there were, you know, maybe tens of thousands of people around the world looking for the same thing. Then I, you know, I dipped my toes in, and I just started to do little videos on my iPhone, sitting on my bed in my bedroom, like no planned out anything, and just talking about what I was going through and my symptoms and whatnot. And the reaction was immediate, so I knew there was a need there. And it was also really healing for me to do it and therapeutic. So it just steadily grew from there organically. I was doing vlog style, and then after a while, I think it evolved, and I was like, okay, I've been sharing my personal life, but the research is really interesting. The news is really interesting. So let me like be curious and explore these other aspects. And the audience has been so excited and interested to go on those journeys as well. So it's really just about sharing my own curiosity, my own life as I'm exploring HIV, and other people happen to have that same desire. And now it's at the point where it's become a huge part of my life. I do a ton of advocacy, go to conferences and speak, and do weekly HIV news videos now and things like that. It's really fulfilling.
Well, you've created really amazing content, and I think it's more important than ever in a time where the federal government has been pulling back access to such important, critical information around HIV and AIDS.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's been so much gatekeeping as it is, even prior to, especially when it comes to research, science. People feel so disconnected, and it feels like, you know, these people are working in this ivory tower with all these erudites talking about high-minded things, and the community really doesn't have access to it. I mean, a lot of these articles and journals that get released are literally behind paywalls. So to be able to have access to those things and help to try to translate it in a way that, like, someone who's not trained in science, because I'm not, I've had to learn as I go, to try to translate that for everyone, I think that's helpful for people to understand what's happening, to feel included, and then also hopefully start to bridge some trust between community and healthcare, community and science and medicine.
There really is so much to talk about, isn't there? And you've been putting out content on a weekly basis or more frequently. I mean, I think I see new content from you all the time. This is going to be a monthly segment on our show, so give our listeners a sense of what you plan to cover.
Yeah, admittedly, it's going to be difficult to distill a month's worth of news into one segment. It's like every single day there's something totally new happening. Supreme Court rulings, you know, funding cuts or what have you, different people getting pulled out of organizations and placed in. So I definitely want to hit like the top really impactful headlines of what's going on, not just in the US, but globally, sub-Saharan Africa, with different organizations, and just make sure that people feel up to date. And sometimes it's hard because all this stuff kind of feels disparate. It's all over the place. So to curate that into something that's tangible and edible in a small bite and feel like you're kind of caught up to speed.
Well, I think too, the unique part of your segment is going to be not only the facts and figures and data that you're going to be sharing from around the world, but also how all of that impacts you personally as an individual and someone living with HIV. I think that's unique and really something special for our listeners.
Yeah, I appreciate that because, you know, it's been an objective of mine to have a bit of journalistic integrity in the way that I cover these things. So yes, I am sharing objectively what's going on, but then I'm also sharing my own opinion. And I just, as a human being, like operating in the world, I want to be open-minded and level-headed and balanced in my approach and the way that I perceive things. And I tend to think that I have a certain amount of empathy. So I try to see all sides of things rather than just being like on one side and really, I don't know, biased, I guess. So yes, I'll have my own opinion, but I really try to be balanced about it.
Well, I'm so grateful to have you part of our Outbeat News team. Where can our listeners go to follow you and see all of your video content?
Yeah, my name is Raif Derazi, and it's spelled Raifderrazi. You can find me on all social media. If you Google my name, you'll find it there as well.
Great. And you'll also find a link on our website at outbeatnews.com. Just look on the left side of the page for a picture of Raif and a link to his YouTube channel. Now, here's his first report.
I'm so thrilled to be bringing you the latest HIV news. And in this very first segment, there is certainly a lot to cover. In mid-July, Congress pushed back on a proposed $400 million cut to PEPFAR, the U.S.'s President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, successfully preventing a rollback of crucial global HIV funding. PEPFAR has been credited with saving more than 25 million lives since 2003. This abrupt reversal comes after earlier freezes on foreign aid, including PEPFAR, were enacted under White House directives this past January. The cuts have already disrupted services in countries such as South Africa, Mozambique, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, and many others, leading to clinic closures, loss of supply chains, and sharp spikes in infections, with modeling estimating 4 million additional AIDS deaths by 2029. If this trend is not reversed. While the PEPFAR funding is helpful, it should be noted that these funds are still limited by recent restrictions against DEI, anything related to abortions, sex work, LGBTQ+, and other key populations. For a virus that disproportionately impacts key populations, this will continue to have detrimental effects. UNAIDS released the 2025 Global AIDS Update on July 10th. It warns that sudden international aid cuts, especially from the US, could lead to 6 million new infections and 4 million AIDS-related deaths by 2029. UNAIDS Executive Director Winnie Byanyima described herself as shaken and disgusted, emphasizing that regions like Eastern and Southern Africa, which represent half the global HIV burden, face existential threats. Still, the report also highlights resilience. 25 low- and middle-income countries are increasing domestic HIV budgets, totaling an 8% collective increase, or roughly $180 million, for 2026. On the flip side, progress in the fight against stigma is stalling, with an uptick in punitive laws against LGBTQ+, and key populations that further drive people from treatment. Meanwhile, domestically, it's yet to be seen how recent cuts to Medicaid via the One Big Beautiful Bill's passage will impact people living with HIV in the U.S., as well as HIV prevention efforts. The International Conference on HIV Science was held in Kigali, Rwanda this year from July 13th to July 17th. During the conference, the WHO announced groundbreaking guidelines recommending lenacapavir, a twice-yearly injectable, as a new PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis option, formulated by Gilead Sciences. Lenacapavir, also known as Yeztugo, was FDA-approved in June and shown to be nearly 100% effective at stopping HIV infection. Its long-acting format is especially helpful for those facing adherence challenges or stigma. Simultaneously, WHO endorsed long-acting injectable cabotegravir plus rilpivirine, also known as Cabenuva, as a treatment option for those living with HIV and already virally suppressed. This is something typically administered once every 2 months. Vive Healthcare expanded its licensing deal with the medicine's patent pool, allowing generic manufacturing of long-acting cabotegravir for 133 low- and middle-income countries, including many in sub-Saharan Africa. While Gilead Sciences has agreed to offer a supply of 2 million doses of lenacapavir at lower cost for low- and middle-income countries, negotiations are still in progress. Meanwhile, at IAS 2025, Merck revealed Phase 2 results for MK-8527, a once-monthly oral pill, and announced upcoming Phase 3 trials to take place in Africa. These developments mark a pivotal shift, offering long-acting options that reduce pill fatigue and broaden equitable access worldwide. One study presented at the conference demonstrated a clear preference for long-acting options. But at the end of the day, one size doesn't fit all, and simply having more options is the key takeaway. Despite medical breakthroughs, gaps remain. Clinics across Zimbabwe have rationed ARVs, forcing patients to pay for drugs or go without, highlighting the disconnect between innovation and access. Modeling at IAS 2025 showed skyrocketing risk. U.S. PrEP cuts could leave over 700,000 people without prevention in sub-Saharan Africa and add 6,700 infections in just 1 year, and far more over 5 years. While some countries are stepping up domestically, South Africa boosting its AIDS budget annually by about 5.9%, UNAIDS stresses that domestic efforts alone won't plug the gap. Global solidarity remains essential. Though much of the news presented at IAS 2025 about impacts to research and HIV services in Africa and low-middle-income countries around the world was fairly grim, there was a remarkable sense of hope and optimism and commitment to finding new sources of support in the fight to end HIV. The ability to be more resilient and less reliant on one source of support is going to be key for many countries around the world moving forward. As July closes, the message is clear. Science is advancing. Long-acting injectables, generic licensing, oral pills in the pipeline. But these gains risk being eclipsed by unstable international funding and political shifts. Protection of PEPFAR funding was a critical win, but vigilance is needed. And more cuts in the U.S. are being proposed for next year's budget. We need sustained global support, equitable distribution of innovations, and legal reforms protecting key and vulnerable populations. This is no time to slow down. National governments, donors, communities, and advocates must stand together to ensure we don't lose hard-fought progress. For Outbeat News in Depth, I'm Raif Darazi.
That was Raif Darazi, the newest member of the Outbeat News in Depth team. You'll hear him every month with an update on HIV and AIDS. Right. All right. So let's jump into some conversation with Finn Dearheart about some of the top news stories we've been reading about this month. Finn, how are you?
Hello, Greg. It's pretty good.
It's good. You having
all
a good summer
considered.
So far?
Yeah. Ella, what is a good summer right now? Yeah, I'm having a pretty good summer, also a heart-heavy summer, and doing what I can to stay centered and engaged.
All right. Hey, so what did you think about the author in the book that we discussed earlier in the show? You had some questions that came up for you about it.
I was appreciating this idea of queerness as a way to, you know, it is a, initially for most, it is a way to be cut off from acceptance, inclusion, and that there's a superpower in that and being able to look back and have gifts to provide. And mm-hmm. This idea of like escape velocity, which is something that Lisa Duggan, she's a queer feminist writer, talks about escape velocity and being like your queerness is something that can help you break out of the orbit of, you know, the family unit from which you've come, and that when you can do that, it allows you to keep evolving. And I just love that idea. I think that's one of the things that he's positioning is the way that queerness can be a vector of evolution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For me, it was really interesting. And one of the things that drew me to his story was his religious upbringing and his vocation in ministry. We grew up in the Catholic Church as well. And so we shared a lot of that same experience. And I think he survived primarily because he never heard sort of that very negative, constant barrage of you're going to hell, you're a sinner, you're wrong, you're disordered from the pulpit. He didn't really get that. And so he was able to navigate that in a way that made spirituality important to him and important to his life. The other thing that really struck me about the book is his use of lists. I think that's one of the unique things about it. And he talked about that, how for him, making lists is very important. And it provides some structure and order to things. And he did that in the book. And it's really a fun way to read his story.
Yeah, you know, also I'm intrigued by this idea around individual choice, you know, and position, especially right now in the nexus of our cultural unraveling / evolution, however, wherever you want to stand on the seesaw. But it's like how individual choice is situated in a wider context of privilege. And what is that? What is choice? And in what context is somebody? And the dimensions of that individual choice is quite different from person to person. And sure. Was really curious to hear him share about that, being in a social class and whiteness being a way the individual choice is highlighted differently than it might be for someone who doesn't have that. And what and kind of what mm-hmm. is his response and thought about that? That's an ongoing thing that I think about myself. Mm-hmm. You know, like if choice is predicated on like an interconnectedness that we all have and that we're all interconnected, but there's so many ways in culture that white supremacy ensures that we don't feel that interconnectedness. So yeah, I'm just curious about that as an ongoing question for me, for mm-hmm. everybody, you know, what is choice?
Yeah. Well, and you know, there's a couple of stories this month that we can dive into that restrict that. I mean, the first one that I saw here that I think is important, especially for trans folks right now, the Trump administration, of course, very early on in the administration, declared that there are only two genders and has done everything they can possibly do to dismiss anything other than male and female. But what is important for trans folks to know that we discussed in the news earlier this month is that the courts have said, despite the Trump administration's ruling, that you are entitled to have an X put as a gender marker on your passport. And as of June 17th, the federal government must honor that. Whether they will or not remains to be seen, but at least the courts have said that, no, you have the ability to have this X gender marker. And of course, in California on driver's licenses, we've had this for some time. You know, I worked in law enforcement for years and years. And of course, from the government perspective, identification is important. But I have to say that of all of the different indicators or markers on a piece of ID, the gender indication is the least valuable in terms of identifying somebody. I mean, the way I think about it, if the gender marker, according to the government, is supposed to indicate what genitalia you have, when you present me with that identification, I have no way of knowing if that's accurate or not, and it's irrelevant.
Yeah.
Never a traffic stop, never a pedestrian stop, never an investigation did that ever matter.
Yeah.
Right? It was about, did the person's picture match how they look? You know, the name is important, the address is important, the age perhaps is important, although that's difficult to verify just looking at somebody. But the gender marker itself is the least important, yet that seems to be so monumentally important to this current administration.
You watched that executive order back in January when he rolled that out?
I did.
It was just egregious. It was so difficult to watch, not just because of the content, but just like, I think the lack of reality that he lives in.
And the denial
of the people that support.
And the denial of science. The denial of psychiatric science, the denial of medical science, the denial of the people who we look to as the experts who have told us that there is more than one gender, that this idea that male and female is it is a mistake, it's wrong. And yet the federal government has said, nope.
I know. I mean, I think of this in such a wide context. Like, as I try to make sense of things, this is just the way I think and write. But it's like if I zoom so far out to where it's like, what's at stake with this? I mean, like living in a plural world and an increasingly awareness, I should say, of that plural world, because it's always been plural. Like this doubling down on such a binary gender, like we're making America first, you know, this kind of like rhetoric is in service to something. And I think it's in service to the flow of capital, really. It's at a really high level, but like this idea of gender in any way, I mean, I've been influenced by, been heavily influenced by this writer, Avi Sacatapolo and Ann Pellegrini. And they do a lot to explicate Laplanchian metapsychology, which is the whole thing from like, I guess around the 80s. But the whole point that I have taken away from that is that gender is not something that we're born with. It's something that we acquire through complex psychic processes. And when I really got that, I could feel in myself how much gender is a continual reaffirmation in oneself, and it's really generated by one's unconscious dynamics internally in response to the world. And in that, it is like something that's constantly malleable and changeable. And I think that from a high level, if gender goes as the really rigid binary system, everything else does. I mean, it's such a way of organizing, like a scaffolding around a world that is malleable and changeable, and that we could change. Like, mm-hmm. we could change so much about the world if we were to be able to come together and feel that unity. And so anyway, I think that it's about that at some deep level, about really needing to reinforce this flow of power.
Yeah, no, I know. And, you know, when I say that gender marker is the least important thing on a piece of ID, that's really from a government perspective. I know mm-hmm. that for individuals, that gender marker right. is very important.
Yeah.
And so if it's the least valuable to the government in terms of identifying somebody, why don't we honor the importance of that as a gender marker? We honor a person's name. The federal government doesn't honor their pronoun choice or pronoun yeah. use, but we recognize that that's important. Just seems to me either we should eliminate it as a marker at all on a piece of ID, or allow someone to put the gender marker on there that matches who they are.
Yeah, I mean, well, if they, like I said, if gender goes as a way of like organizing reality, then we have to contend with the fact that all the injustices that we perpetuate and are complicit in are our doings. You know what I mean? I think like trans bodies are the sites at which this is like visible, but it's not like it. Cis people are just as much a part of the ongoing gender replication. Like, we're making it up. And so, yeah, I think they have a considerable amount of interest in eliminating the perception, you know, that gender is one's own,
mm-hmm.
that it is something individual to you that you come to acquire through your own life and your experience. Because if you were, yeah, if that starts to slip, it's just like everything else starts to go like to from the top down. You know what I mean? Like
right.
if culture is not organized around really conservative principles that seek to maintain the flow of goods and power, you know, if we really had full possession of our bodies and our sex drives and our expression of gender and our minds, and you know, like, we're not going to be inducted into this flow that goes up to where it goes now, which yeah. is an increasingly whitewashed billionaire class, you know.
Well, what else did you see in the news? What stood out to you this month?
So what else do we see? Well, okay, so I was really like, I get personally like affected by these sorts of stories, but the Stephen Falco minister in Indiana, the church, calling for the death of LGBT people. And it's so that the church was trying to backpedal about that and say, well, we're not saying that individuals should try to go out and kill them, but the government should, because it's inciting, of course.
Yeah. And it sounds obviously completely ridiculous, but when people make those kinds of statements and then it's put into print and then it's circulated amongst the media as, you know, perhaps outrageous, there's people that see that and potentially are going to be inspired by it. Yeah, let's go get them, you know, grab the
right.
pitchforks and torches.
Right.
And that's
not the
first time
yeah.
that's happened, but in this time it's throwing gasoline on a fire.
Yeah, and I'm really actually intrigued. I don't know if you know anything about how this is playing out right now. Are these incidences more common because of the power that's in place? And so it's kind of like encouraging and giving license to this sorts of attack? Or is it like it's always been there and now our focus is more tuned into it? Like, I don't know. Like, I don't have the kind of sociological data that would help me understand that.
I suspect that there is some of that at least in play. I mean, an example, ICE has always, even in the Biden administration, arrested people and deported them. But now that it's a focus, we hear about every story, every time that it's been detected that ICE has made an arrest and is deporting someone. And so when you start seeing all of those stories published together, it looks like all of a sudden there's this huge problem. I'm not saying that there isn't a problem. There clearly is. But another example would be back in 2009-10 when the media was really picking up on LGBT youth suicides. This is probably a better example. LGBT youth suicides have always been 3 to 4 times greater than cisgendered straight suicide rates in young people.
Uh-huh.
But the media was sharing every story that was found.
Right.
And so it made it look like there was this epidemic of LGBT youth suicides. And because you don't hear them now doesn't mean that that problem isn't still there.
Yeah.
To your point or to your question, I think that there have been conservative Christian and Islamic and other faith leaders, conservative leaders, who have made those kinds of statements and those callings before and for some time. I've seen and read other stories where, you know, this sort of rogue minister will go out and make a statement like that and the press publishes it and it's seen as outrageous. What I think is different today is that conservatism in whole is, I don't know, more widely accepted, more interested, being played out. It's certainly at the heart of the federal administration right now. And so those kinds of religious leaders do feel sort of empowered to be able to make those outrageous statements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I always naturally assume that those people are closeted. I mean, it's not like a one-to-one fair assumption, I don't think, but I do,
there's something
encountered there. People like,
Yes. Where does that passionate hatred come from?
Yeah. Personal reaction, right? Where is this personal reaction in you coming from?
Right.
We don't see drag queens getting arrested for, you know, in public bathrooms with minors. It's always people like this guy.
Yep. That's absolutely right. Hey, talk about trans women. You witnessed or saw a story in San Francisco about a trans woman who was at an asylum.
Oh, yeah, Hillary Rivers. Yeah, well, she went to an asylum meeting and was actually just arrested by ICE. And I don't really know anything further than that at this moment. I just know that there's some activists in San Francisco that are starting to try to work to try to find where is she and what can be done.
I think this is the really scary part, is that as people engage their due process rights, you know, they're showing up to court, they're trying to adhere to process, they're being scooped up.
Kicked off. Yeah.
During those processes, which to me just seems to be a blatant violation of due process rights.
I think one thing that I'm really intrigued about right now is the bill that California is putting forward under Scott Wehner and a few of the other legislators to require ICE agents to wear masks. You know,
or to prohibit them from wearing masks.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah, prohibit them exactly. Yeah, from wearing a mask. And it's just like seeing these pictures. Like it is, how can you cannot see these pictures of these agents and not immediately associate with like people breaking into your house or someone attacking you or kidnappers, right? Like the associations are so obvious to me.
Right, and we've had for a long time in California a law that says police officers have to have identification, a badge number, and a name tag visible on their uniforms, that you can't cover those up when you're engaged in enforcement action. So why on earth would we allow police to become secret by covering their face?
Right. Yeah.
That serves no tactical purpose whatsoever. That is an intimidation factor. That is an anonymity factor, a protection for the individual to go out and commute abuses that otherwise they wouldn't do.
Right. Do you know where that bill is in process right now?
Yeah, people want to follow it. It's Senate Bill 627. It was introduced February by Senators Wehner and Arguin, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And it's still in committee. So it's working its way through committee, and there's been some amendments to it, but it is working its way through the legislature. And I feel pretty confident it'll end up in some form being passed. Well, I guess one other piece of decent news that came out this month was that the United Nations renewed its commitment to monitoring LGBT civil rights. They have what's called their expert on LGBT issues. And if you Google search UN LGBT civil rights, then you'll see this expert's page popped up and the work that he's doing. But he's really working on issues around the world involving LGBT civil rights. And he has been not shy about criticizing both the Trump administration and the U.S. Supreme Court in their decisions that have resulted in some sort of a regress of rights in some form. So I think that is important. I think the United Nations and the rest of the world that still sees and has common sense around this needs to stand up to this along with us. And you mentioned that you saw an article about B being eliminated from the story of Stonewall.
Right. Yeah. I think for me, when I see that, I think, are they just going backwards till they take away L and G as well? Which is the slippery slope piece.
So just for the listeners who haven't heard that story. So the story of Stonewall on the Federal Parks website was pretty quickly revised to remove any comment around transgender people. And of course, trans folks were at the heart of the start.
I know.
Of Stonewall.
So, start.
Yeah, I mean, it's really ridiculous to even think about removing them. But now the language is being censured even further.
Yeah.
And for me, what strikes me when I think about that story is that you would like to think that federal government websites are sources of accurate and reliable information. I tell my students, hey, if you want to use research, look for a .gov website. I don't know that I can say that much anymore.
I can't say that anymore.
History is being revised and rewritten or just eliminated completely. Yeah. And I think a more dangerous example of that is the content that was removed from the CDC's website about HIV and AIDS.
Totally.
That's censorship at its absolute worst.
I'm wondering, like, in response to all of these assaults, you know, that so many of us are working through in our own individual nervous systems, like how we respond, like how do we be in this moment? And, you know, some of us having a collapse kind of response or a fight response, you know, or freezing, and that we have our own timelines with that, you know, but in reaction, the more we band together and the more we make collective action, the more we can feel emboldened. And I'm just curious in you, like just speaking to the part of you, not the part that feels pessimism, but the part that feels optimism and hope, not as just a defense, but as like a potential, like what do you see as the potential possibility around all these assaults for us as people, as a queer community?
Well, I think it underlies the importance of us coming together. You know, we can't fragment out because we have different agendas.
Right.
Organizations of all sizes at the federal level, state level, and local level need to come together. We have to get past our bickering. Local organizations can't be critical of the human rights campaign, for example, because they think, you know, they're too far removed. We need to be linking and partnering with the human rights campaign. We need to lean on our allies, and our allies outside of the U.S. and in organizations like the United Nations and in other countries that, you know, have never had to stand up against the U.S. for their policies, because traditionally I'd like to think we've kind of led the way. But we need to engage our allies as well, and here locally, meaning within our country. We have to engage our allies.
I think so too. Broad coalitions. Really broad coalitions. Yes. Yeah.
Finn, where can people go to follow you?
Yes, please go to my Substack, finndearhart.substack.com. And I put out about once every other week. There's a free newsletter. You can also be a paid subscriber, and there's a weekly publication there.
Fantastic. All right. We will see you next month.
Thank you.
And that wraps up our hour. Be sure to tune in next week for Outbeat Radio's Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Greer. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a fantastic week, and thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Outbeat News in Depth is hosted and produced by Greg Moralia. Our shows are available for on-demand play anytime on our website at outbeatnews.com and on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and now on iHeartRadio. Find links to subscribe at outbeatnews.com. I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to. So I give it up to you. Ah. Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCBFM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County, with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Roanoke Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. The Jazz Hot is next.